Hi, everyone. You're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we bring you the latest trends in the oncology pharmacy space. This week, we're bringing you another Pharmacist Takeover episode, this time focusing on chronic graft-versus-host disease, axatilimab, and the crucial role of pharmacists in treating these patients. So, without further ado, take a seat, relax. I'm going to pass the mic over to our pharmacy experts.
To today's episode, where we'll be talking about chronic graft-versus-host disease, or chronic GVHD, and the role of axatilimab in its management. I'm joined today by two fantastic guests, Sonia Zepkam, who is a hematology-oncology clinical pharmacy specialist at Loyola University Medical Center, where she focuses on bone marrow transplant and cellular therapy. She completed her PharmD at Midwestern University and her residency training at Loyola. Her clinical and research interests include leukemia, multiple myeloma, transplantation, and GVHD. She's also a HOPA and AST active member. Grashma Vadikal is a transplantation and cellular therapy clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. She completed her PharmD at the University of South Florida College of Pharmacy and a PGY1 training at Nebraska Medicine and a PGY2 oncology training at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Her clinical interests include research, particularly in improving long-term outcomes and in stem cell transplant and cell therapies, as well as those who develop steroid refractory GVHD. She is an active member of ASTCT. My name is Leanne Kennedy, and I am the Director of Clinical Oncology for Atrium Health, both at Wake Forest and at LCI. I've been a transplant pharmacist for over 30 years, and I'm happy to be able to moderate today. Today, we're going to walk through the evolving landscape in the treatment of chronic GVHD, its pathophysiology, current treatment strategies, and how axatilimab fits into practice, along with future directions and practical takeaways for clinicians and pharmacists. Sonia, you want to talk first about how we consider an overview of GVHD?
Yeah, I would say that over years, we become much, much better at transplanting patients. However, graft-versus-host disease remains one of the most important complications of allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. It significantly affects the quality of life, and it's a major contributor to morbidity and mortality for our patients. And traditionally, we think about GVHD into two main categories, acute and chronic, with a chronic GVHD occurring in roughly 30 to 50% of our patients. And this depends on factors like HLA match between donor and recipient, graft source, donor and recipient characteristics like age, female to male donor, CMV status, conditioning regimens used, with a myeloablative conditioning being higher risk than reduced intensity and non-myeloablative, and finally, GVHD prophylaxis used as a part of the protocol. However, in the practice, the split is not that clean. Timeline and clinical features can overlap. So now we describe GVHD as a classic acute, late acute, overlap, and classic chronic based on clinical manifestation rather than just strict day before or after 100 days rule.
Right. How are we able to distinguish between acute and chronic GVHD?
Acute and chronic GVHD are really different syndromes, not just different points in time. Acute and chronic GVHD are really different syndromes, not just different points in time. Historically, we used to say that GVHD that developed before 100 days was considered acute, and anything after 100 days post-transplant was considered to be chronic. However, now we have a better understanding of the biology of the disease. Acute and chronic GVHD, we know, presents quite differently. Now we classify it depending on what it looks like, regardless of when it appears post-transplant. And this is further defined by the NIH. When we think of acute GVHD, we think of a process that's driven predominantly by donor T-cell mediated inflammation triggered by conditioning related tissue damage and cytokine release. It mainly affects three organ systems: the skin, the liver, as well as the GI tract. When we look at the skin, acute GVHD typically presents as a macular papular rash. This can be limited to a small BSA, but also the involvement can be quite diffuse, causing erythroderma. I remember when I was a student, my preceptor used to describe acute skin GVHD as a big red angry rash. In the liver, we can see elevated bilirubin as well as elevated liver enzymes. And in the GI tract, we can see anorexia, nausea, vomiting, watery diarrhea, abdominal pain, and in very severe cases, we can see bleeding, ileus, and even GI perforation. These features can occur early or late, which is why we now talk about classic acute or late acute GVHD. Now, contrast that with chronic GVHD. This is a more complex and disorder that resembles fibrotic disorders. It involves immune dysregulation of B cells, macrophages, as well as fibroblasts. And unlike acute GVHD, chronic GVHD can actually affect any organ in the body. With modern prophylaxis, especially in the era of post-transplant cyclophosphamide, the incidence of chronic GVHD has decreased, but when it does develop, it's one of the biggest determinants of long-term transplant outcomes. So, classic chronic GVHD can look like scleroderma, Sjögren's, or bronchiolitis obliterans. And unlike acute GVHD, as I mentioned, chronic GVHD can affect any organ system. But some of the more common organ systems we could see it in is the skin. It could present as lichenoid changes, sclerosis, pigment changes, as well as tightness. Nails could present as brittle, rigid, splitting, or in severe cases, fall off. Chronic GVHD, if it affects the hair, it can affect cause thinning or patchy alopecia. In the mouth, we can see dryness, sensitivity, ulcerations, as well as lichenoid lesions. In the eyes, we can see severe dryness, irritation, photophobia, as well as corneal abrasions. In the esophagus, patients can develop strictures or dysphagia from the fibrosis. In the lungs, bronchiolitis obliterans syndrome, or BOS, can be seen. Muscle, joints, or fascia, patients can experience weakness, contractures, limited range of motion. And in the genitalia, it can cause dryness, ulceration, scarring, with major impacts on sexual health. Because it's so multi-system, chronic GVHD really requires a multidisciplinary approach when it comes to treatment. A team of physicians, pharmacists, ophthalmologists, dermatologists, PT, OT, dentists, and others. And finally, it's important to note that we can also see an overlap GVHD where acute and chronic features both coexist.
It's really amazing how we've seen GVHD and our understanding really grow and develop over the past, 30 years, especially as I've been practicing in transplant. As we think about what is our current standard of care and what the limitations are, Sonia, can you tell us a little bit about that?
So for the mild chronic GVHD, we typically focus to just stable local therapies. Therefore, topical steroids, calcineurin inhibitors, lubricating eye drops, oral rinses, physical occupational therapies, and really just trying to control symptoms without any systemic immunosuppression. However, for moderate to severe disease, the backbone is still systemic corticosteroids. Typically, we use prednisone equivalent dose of 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilo per day, and this is often given in combination with calcineurin inhibitors, either like tacrolimus or sirolimus, or addition of mTOR inhibitors such as sirolimus. The problem here is that we still don't have steroid-free first-line option. Long-term steroids brings many side effects like weight gain, infections, osteosporosis, metabolic complications, myopathy, and so much more. So we are eager as community to just find alternatives. For patients who are steroid refractory and steroid dependent or intolerant, treatment is shifting away from broad immunosuppression to now targeted therapies, which aligns with the biology of chronic GVHD. So far, we have extracorporeal photopheresis or ECP, which has immunomodulating effect on T cell regulation. We have ruxolitinib or JAK1 and 2 inhibitor, which reduces the inflammatory cytokine signaling. Belumosetil or ROCK2 inhibitor. This agent addresses immune imbalance and fibrosis. And BTK inhibitor ibrutinib, which modulates B cell activation. And most recently, the CSF1R pathway has emerged as important targeted therapeutic target, opening the door for macrophage-focused therapies like axatilimab, the latest chronic GVHD therapies approved in 2024 by FDA. Despite the progress, we still need more durable responses, better first-line therapies, and strategies that meaningfully will improve long-term quality of life for our patients.
Axatilimab is one of those really exciting new therapies. Gray, tell us a little bit about the mechanism of action and maybe how it differs from some of our other current therapies.
Yeah, so axatilimab is really exciting because it goes after a cell type we haven't directly targeted before in chronic GVHD. It has activity against monocytes and tissue macrophages. So CSF1 is a key growth factor that drives the development and survival of these cells. They're central in chronic inflammation and fibrosis, which is exactly the process that causes the sclerotic skin, the fascia tightening, or damage to that we see in the other organs. So axatilimab is a humanized IgG4 monoclonal antibody directed against the CSF1 receptor. So when we block CSF1, it reduces signaling in this pathway, which decreases differentiation and pro-fibrotic activity of the CSF1 are expressing monocytes and macrophages. The FDA recently approved this in August of 2024 based upon the results of the AGAVE-201 trial in patients with chronic GVHD who had failed at least two prior systemic therapies. And this is different from the current targeted agents that we have on the market. And these would include ruxolitinib, which reduces inflammation and cytokine signaling through the JAK pathway, belumosudil, which targets ROCK2, as well as ibrutinib, which targets BTK and B cells. Axatilimab focuses on macrophage biology, so mechanistically, we think of it as more complementary than redundant. And that's especially valuable for patients who have already had a JAK inhibitor or ROCK2 inhibitor and still have active fibrosis-driven chronic GVHD.
Oh, Sonia, you want to tell us a little bit about this AGAVE-201 trial?
Yes, of course. This was pivotal trial, AGAVE-201, which was phase two open label randomized multicenter study, which compared three axatilimab dosing regimens in recurrent and refractory chronic GVHD patients. The key design points for the study were that it included patients who are 2 years and older with active chronic GVHD, required to have at least two prior systemic therapies, and patient who could stay on a background steroids, calcineurin inhibitors, and mTOR inhibitors throughout the study. The primary endpoint for the study was overall response rate, which is defined as complete response and partial response at week 24, which is cycle 7, day 1. This was the group of heavily pretreated patients with severe disease and often advanced sclerosis. They had a median for prior lines of therapy and up to 15. Among 214 patients, overall response rate at week 24 was as follows. For 3 milligram per kilo every 4 weeks group, it was 50%. For 1 milligram per kilo every 2 weeks was 67. And finally, for 0.3 milligram per kilo every 2 weeks was 74. And this was the highest overall response rate noted in the study and the FDA approved dose. Median time to response was about 2 months, and this varied by organ involvement. Many patients could taper or discontinue steroids by cycle 7, and symptom improvement often occurred within 1 to 2 months, supporting both objective and patient-reported outcomes. Safety-wise, the most common adverse event reflected depletion of tissue macrophages, especially Kupffer cell, and this was noted in transient LFT elevation, CPK elevation, and periorbital edema. These events were generally reversible and not associated with end organ damage. Infusion reactions occur about 8% of patients, and hypersensitivity was more frequent in patients with neutralizing antibodies, about 26% of patients versus 4 without, which usually happened with the later cycles. And based on this data, axatilimab again is approved at dose of 0.3 milligram per kilo every 2 weeks for adult and pediatric patients who weigh 40 kilogram and above, and who failed at least two prior systemic treatment therapies.
That's so exciting to be able to see new data and for data both in adult and pediatric patients. Gary, are there certain patient populations who may benefit more than others?
Definitely. From looking at AGAVE-201, axatilimab's activity is broad, but there are certain organ patterns that really stand out. So patients with gastrointestinal involvement, including the upper GI, lower GI, and esophageal disease, these patients had some of the highest response rates with some of the earliest improvements within 1 to 2 months. And that's huge when you think about how the GI system affects nutrition, weight, and quality of life. And 1 to 2 months may sound like a long period of time, but when you think of chronic GVHD, ADHD, you have to remember that it's something that develops over a long period of time. So sometimes this could be even years after transplant. So to reverse the damage and gain back function of those different organ systems, it's going to take time. In patients with joint and fascial involvement, they had response rates with about 3/4, with improvement in stiffness and range of motion, typically within 1 to 2 months. In pulmonary GVHD, including BOS, axatilimab achieved responses in about half the patients over 2 to 3 months. And even though this onset is slower, this is very meaningful because this is a setting where options are very limited, especially in those patients who do have chronic GVHD of the lung, as it is a major driver of morbidity. We also saw activity in the skin, the eyes, and the liver, and especially in patients who had been through JAK inhibitors as well as ROCK inhibitors. So right now, axatilimab appears to be particularly helpful for GI prominent chronic GVHD, esophageal disease, the liver, joint fascia sclerosis or contractures, pulmonary chronic GVHD, and even found to be beneficial in patients who had failed multiple lines of therapy prior.
It's such exciting data, and really to be able to know that we have some ways that we can target and focus which patients really should be beneficial, especially as we're counseling them and starting therapies to help them to know what they should expect. That's so exciting. Sonia, how about talking about real world and how we apply these to our patients? Are there certain ways that we should maybe sequence these therapies and trying to figure out when do we start with one drug versus the next?
Yes, in the guideline, axatilimab is currently listed as a second line option after steroids and at least one additional systemic therapy. However, day-to-day practice looks a little bit differently, and we adding it a little bit later in the course of treatment. The main reason is actually very practical. Axatilimab is IV infusion, so we have to navigate insurance, infusion chair time, and in some situation having the central line for patients. In contrast to agents like belumosudil and ruxolitinib, they're oral and easier to start. So real-world sequencing often looks more like steroids, ruxolitinib, or belumosudil, and then going to axatilimab. And this pattern is not about efficacy, it's about logistics and also treating center practice and their experience with this new drug. When axatilimab is added, we typically continue steroids and taper them slowly as tolerated. As we saw in the study, that most of the patients were able to tolerate off the steroids by week 7. And calcineurin inhibitors are often maintained if the patient is already on it. Whether we continue ruxolitinib or belumosudil is very individualized decision. Some centers taper them off and other maintain dual therapies based on organ involvement, tolerance, and infections risk. We don't have standardized strategies yet for tapering off axatilimab. Most of us anticipate eventually this being spacing out the infusion rather than by stopping abruptly and if patient is stable. Given all of this, I think that axatilimab is currently most often used in a later line for fibrosis-driven disease and for patients who still have significant symptoms after multiple line of therapies, particularly involving fascia and esophagus, GI tract, and lungs.
So, Grant, I know the study had that dose escalation, the 0.31 and 0.3. So the approved regimen has that 0.3. How is that given? I know we've talked about IV and how often they come in. What does that mean for our patients?
The dosing is actually pretty straightforward. As you mentioned, AGAVE-201 had the 3 dosing regimens, but the FDA approval and the dosing where they found the most efficacy was the 0.3 mg per kg IV that's dosed every 2 weeks. And the infusion itself is only 30 minutes, and it's approved for adults and pediatric patients who are at least 40 kilograms. There are no renal dose adjustments, and dose modifications are mostly driven by tolerability. Monitoring for axatilimab focuses on LFTs, so we look at AST, ALT, because of axatilimab's effects on Kupffer cells, actually, we do see transient increases in AST and ALT, but if you look in the actual AGAVE-201 study, the elevations were quite mild, with only a small percentage of patients experiencing grade 4 elevations. So these are typically transient and may resolve to mostly mild. We could also see periorbital edema as well as CPK elevations. There is a warning for infusion reactions and hypersensitivity. However, it's important to note that pre-meds are not required, but you can consider them in patients who do develop infusion-related reactions. The package insert provides a clear stepwise guidance on when to hold, reduce, or space out doses based upon lab thresholds or toxicities. Though what we've really seen in clinical practice is that it's very well tolerated. So overall, from a logistics standpoint, if you have infusion capacity and good monitoring parameters, then axatilimab is actually quite manageable.
So, Sonia, are there other drug events or adverse reactions that we need to watch, or even drug interactions that we need to consider?
Yeah, so for adverse events profile, as Gray said already, it's mostly related to its mechanism of action and effect on the monocytes and macrophages and those Kupffer cells in the liver. So transient elevation of AST, ALT, bilirubin, and CPK elevations and hypersensitivity reactions there observed. However, the drug itself does not have any drug interactions. It's very clean drug. It's not substrate for CYP enzymes or inhibitor, so we don't have to worry about any major drug-drug interactions. However, we are concerned mostly about cumulative toxicity of other hepatotoxic agents when we are monitoring for transient elevation of AST and ALT, and also overlapping immunosuppression concern for additional risk for infections. Therefore, infection management is key here. For my experience and talking to other centers, for mild outpatient infections, we typically continue GVHD therapy, including axatilimab, to avoid a flare. However, if the infection is more severe, especially if require hospitalization, it's very common to temporarily hold axatilimab and other novel agents, adjusting dose of steroids and calcineurin inhibitors. But this also depends on the clinical situation. As Gray also said, when LFT rise, we actually have really good package insert that tells us stepwise process, pause, review other hepatotoxic medication, and monitor for infections and GVHD progression, and then reintroduce therapies as appropriate. This overall safety profile is very predictable, very manageable, but required a close monitoring.
Well, it sounds like this is a great role for the pharmacist to help. And I think we'd all agree as pharmacists that we're essential to the care of the patients. But Gray, do you want to talk maybe more learning points for those that may be listening today? If you're educating patients, what do they really need to know?
So pharmacists are a central component of chronic GVHD care, especially as regimens become more complex. We can help with therapy selection and sequencing, weighing in organ involvement, prior therapies, comorbidities, and logistics to decide where axatilimab would fit in a patient's treatment regimen. We can help with dosing and preparation, making sure that patients are getting an accurate weight-based dose, proper dilution, and there's safe infusion practices. For monitoring and toxicity, we can keep track of LFT, CPK, and symptoms and guide dose adjustments per the package insert. For infection management, we can balance the need for GVHD control with infection risk when patients are on multiple immune suppressants. And remember, these patients are not just immune suppressed from the GVHD treatment, but also from chronic GVHD itself. With interactions and overlap assessments, we can tease apart whether a lab abnormality is due to axatilimab or is it due to tacrolimus, azoles, acetaminophen, infections, GVHD, or other things going on with the patient. As far as access and coordination, since axatilimab is a new drug, we could assist with prior authorizations, finding financial assistance, scheduling infusions, and as well as troubleshooting delays. And we are vital in helping to educate patients, explaining the mechanism of how it works, how long it'll take to work, expectations for response, side effects management, monitoring, and when to call the team when things aren't going right. So in short, pharmacists help to make sure axatilimab is used appropriately, it's used safely and efficiently, and that patients understand and feel supported throughout their therapy.
Well, it definitely sounds like an exciting option for our patients, but are there any challenges or even barriers when it comes to treating patients with axatilimab?
Yeah, there definitely are. Even with the strong data, bringing any new therapy to practice isn't going to be always simple. Some of these key challenges that we come across are going to be access and cost. High-cost drugs have often variable payer coverage and lengthy prior authorizations, which can delay start. Copays could be really high, so financial assistance and advocacy become super crucial. And identifying the right candidates, axatilimab has broad activity, but we do think that patients with GI predominant disease, esophageal involvement, fascia joint sclerosis, or lung involvement may benefit the most. But also, as patients are further out from transplant, they not, may not be seen as frequently by their transplant providers. Sometimes appointments and follow-ups aren't for months or even once a year, especially as they're stable. So it's important that we educate patients on early signs of chronic GVHD, so they don't wait until their next appointment for the disease process to be identified. And at that point, the chronic GVHD might be a bit more advanced. Balancing efficacy and tolerability may be a challenge. We're talking about heavily pretreated, immune-suppressed patients already on steroids, Tacro, azoles, ruxolitinib, or belumosudil. We're always weighing the benefits against liver enzyme, CPK elevations, infusion visits, infection risk, and much of the art of chronic GVHD care is managing the cumulative treatment burden. And awareness and comfort. Axatilimab, it has a new mechanism and toxicity profile. Some clinicians and pharmacists need time to get educated and have real-world experience and have comfortable ability using it. Case discussions, institutional protocols, and practice workflows really help with adopting axatilimab into practice. So addressing these barriers is essential for making sure axatilimab reaches the patients who stand to benefit the most. And then, when you think of how much time it takes for treatments like axatilimab to work, you also have to think of the current symptom burden with the patient. Non-compliance can be an issue if patients don't see immediate improvement from their GVHD targeted therapies. So, supportive care through a multidisciplinary approach becomes crucial to alleviate symptoms. There are actually some centers that offer a GVHD clinic, which is a multidisciplinary day where a patient can come in and see not just their transplant provider, but also their dermatologist, rehab medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, and other crucial supportive care services that are going to be vital in improving symptom burden for these patients.
That's so exciting. And to be able to, know again that this is a multidisciplinary team that's really taking care of these patients. Sonia, is there anything else out in the future that we need to be watching for?
We're actually in a really exciting moment for chronic GVHD. Our understanding of pathophysiology has broadened just from purely T cell-driven inflammation to now include B cells, macrophages, fibroblasts, and tissue remodeling pathways, which is exactly why now we have JAK, ROCK2, BTK, and CSF1 receptor targeted therapies. Looking ahead, now we have studies that evaluate combination and early line use of existing therapies like ruxolitinib and belumosudil and axatilimab in early lines or in combination with either steroids, with each other, or with the ECP. And the goal here is to intervene before fibrosis happens. We also have new agents, new kids on the block, rovodecitinib, which is a dual JAK1 and 2 and ROCK1 and 2 inhibitor all in one. This medication may simultaneously target both inflammation and fibrosis, and phase three for this medication is on horizon. We also potentially will have a pimivokotinib, which is an oral CSF1 receptor inhibitor, which could offer macrophage-directed therapies without need of IV infusion like we have with axatilimab right now. And then where there is a work done in prevention and early intervention with ORCA-T graft manipulation and also optimizing PTCy strategies may reduce severe chronic GVHD. And this is especially important for those myeloablative and mismatched donor setting patients. And lastly, we have improvement in using biomarkers and precision medicine in chronic GVHD as work has been done in ongoing for day 100 blood-based biomarkers and immune signature. And this involves CXCL9, STAT2, BAFF, and macrophage markers. And this might predict who will develop chronic GVHD and which pathway will be dominant. That could allow truly pathway pathway specific treatment instead of just purely organ based decision making. And ultimately, all of this is about long term survivorship, helping patients not just live longer after transplant, but really, really live better, less fibrosis, better function, and of course, fewer chronic GVHD symptoms.
You're right. It is such an exciting time for our patients to be able to see where we've come again in the time that I've been practicing, but to see the new things that are out on the in the future, it's just really exciting to be able to know that we're not done yet improving the care for our patients. So, Grady, you want to kind of summarize some of the key takeaways for us?
Yeah, so just to summarize key takeaway points for clinicians and pharmacists, chronic GVHD is biologically distinct from acute GVHD. It's driven by inflammation, autoimmunity, and fibrosis across multiple organ systems. Axatilimab adds a macrophage-targeted approach that's especially promising in GI, esophageal, fascial joint, and pulmonary involvement, and in patients who've tried other agents. The safety profile is predictable and manageable with good monitoring of LFT, CPK, as well as infection risks. Pharmacists are essential in sequencing, monitoring, toxicity management, access, and patient education. They're an essential part of the multidisciplinary approach that should be taken for every patient with chronic GVHD. And finally, as the landscape evolves, staying informed and flexible is going to be very critical as we integrate these new agents and combinations safely into practice.
Sonia, what excites you the most?
What excites me the most is how quickly the field is moving towards smarter, earlier, more precise therapies, better prevention, earlier second-line use, rational combinations, and truly biology-driven treatment selection. There is no longer just trying to control GVHD symptoms. We are now working towards preserving function, independence, and quality of life of patients after transplant. Seeing different response among different organs tells us there is no single pathway that may influence all organs, and that each organ may be actually influenced by different pathway that we can target. Therefore, one of the most significant insights driving the shift is recognition that different organs behave very differently in chronic GVHD. Some tissues are extremely refractory, and it often reflects variations in macrophage content. And this confirms that the fact that chronic GVHD isn't driven by one single inflammatory pathway. Different organ can be dominated by distinct biological processes like T cell driven, B cell driven, macrophage driven, or fibrosis driven. That's why we see different responses pattern across organs, and why therapies like axatilimab, which targets macrophage pathway, offer such a meaningful addition. Ultimately, the future is moving forward organ and pathway-specific therapies, matching the drug's mechanisms of the biology of the organ involved, and that's what makes this moment of chronic GVHD so exciting.
Wow, there's so much that keeps going on. It's hard to keep up with everything that is moving forward with our patients. Gray, how do you stay up to date?
To stay current, I'd encourage you guys to stay engaged with ASTCT, CIBMTR, EBMT, ASH, and HOPA, as well as following major trial networks like the BMC-CTN and MAGIC to connect with colleagues and understand real-world practice and build a simple routine for scanning high-yield journals and conference summaries. You don't have to read everything, but having regular touch points goes a long way in keeping you prepared for where GVHD management is going to be headed.
Well, it definitely sounds like we need to keep focused on this so that we can be able to help our patients have the best care possible. I really enjoyed talking with you guys today to be able to learn more. I've learned today, and I hope those that have been listening have also been able to learn. And I appreciate being able just to spend some time today with you.
Definitely. Thanks, Leanne.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition. We have more exciting episodes coming up. Next month, we are going to have more pharmacy experts take over the podcast to bring us behind the scenes and talk about a day in the life of a clinical oncology pharmacist. So don't go too far, and I'll see you in the next one.